It's the TEH Podcast, episode number 248, with Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com. This week, Epic versus Apple. AI brings voices back from the dead. The mess of real ID and tech tariffs.
Gary, I want to charge you 30% for doing this podcast.
Well, you would only be able to do that if I made more than $1 million. Because that's, you're of course referring to Apple's fee for people making in-app purchases and stuff through the App Store.
The fee for the privilege of using the App Store.
Yeah. And of course, the thing that people still get wrong, even though it's been years, is that the vast majority of developers are charged 15% for that. It's only if you make more than $1 million that you're charged 30%.
Oh, really? I did not know that.
See? Yeah. And that was one of the changes Apple made, basically them saying, look, we don't want to make a fortune off of the little guys. You know, we want to make a fortune off of the other guys that are already making a fortune. So, yeah, then that's kind of the thing. You know, we're going to, of course, talk a little bit about Epic versus Apple and its reappearance in the news this week. And that's one of the things that I hate about the other side from Apple on this is they constantly refer to 30%, 30%, 30% without qualifying it that, you know, they're making it sound like they're taking 30% from like the small developers, and they're not. They're taking 15% from them.
How does the threshold work? Is it one of those things where, you know, the moment you make $1 million, all of a sudden you have to throw in another 15%? Or is it, I mean,
I don't know. It's spelled out there somewhere.
Is it like the U.S. tax code where you pay 15% on the first $1 million and then 30% after that?
Yeah, I don't think it's like that. I think it might be like an annual thing if you made more. I don't know. Okay. All I know is if I ever made $1 million in in-app purchases from an app, I would celebrate and give Apple their extra 15%. And work on seeing if I could grow that beyond $1 million the next year. But I've never gotten close. Even I've never gotten within three decimal places of that. So you know. But yeah, so the deal is that this week it's back in the news because there's new news. So basically Apple, several years ago, Epic, the maker of the game Fortnite, which is really the main thing here, right? They had this hit game Fortnite that was a hit, not just for players and people talking about it, but because they made a ton of money off of it, mostly through in-app purchases. It's like a free game to play. You could play it totally free. And I have played Fortnite in the past. I've never spent a penny playing Fortnite. But a lot of players like to buy little cosmetic costumes and things and upgrades, all sorts of stuff you can get. So when you buy them, of course, you buy them through whatever system it is you're playing with. If you're playing the game that you downloaded on a PC, you're going through Epic's own little payment system, and that's all fine with everybody. If you're playing on Google Play, you're going through Google's little in-app purchase system. And if you're playing on an Apple device, like the iPhone, you're going through Apple's little purchase system, which both companies force app developers to go through. So in other words, you could make a game and say, hey, you could get a cool top hat for your character in this game, but it's going to cost $4. And out of that $4, 70% goes to the developer, 30% is kept by Apple, assuming that it's a big game and they're making $1 million, right? And Epic basically said, that's not fair. Like, we should have the ability to have our own payment system and people could just pay us directly. And Apple said, hey, it's part of the terms of service of using our thing. We provide the bandwidth. We provide the marketplace. We provide like the download for the app. We provide the whole payment system, charging the card, all of that. Even people just having their Apple account and the money just comes out of there. Like that whole thing, you get that. There's a little API. It's like three lines of code. And now you can have people charge for their top hat in the game. And we're taking 15% from small developers, 30% from big ones. And Epic said, no, we still don't want that. We want to have our own payment system. So they traded lawsuits with Apple. It went to a big court case, and there was a huge finding in that court case. And there were basically 10 points, and 9 out of the 10 of those were ruled in favor of Apple, including them saying, look, Apple doesn't have to let you have your own payment system in the game. Like, Apple doesn't need to do that. Things like that. one of those 10 points was actually saying that, okay, there is this little bit here that says, okay, you can't even tell people that they could buy stuff outside of the game. Like, because the idea is, well, it's a system you log into your account. So if you were to go to like Epic's site or like the PC version of the game, buy the top hat, you should be able to log into your account on the iPhone and then see the top hat. And you can, and you always could, except that in the iPhone version of the game, Apple prohibited you from saying you could. Like, you couldn't link to it and say, hey, go to our website, buy the top hat from us.
And then come back.
Yeah, so they didn't allow that, and that part of it violated a California law. And so the ruling was 9 in favor of Apple, 1 in favor of Epic, saying, yeah, they do have to let you have a link. Like, you should be able to say, here's a link to buy the top hat. And then that goes to a web page. Like, that nothing in the game, whatever. So Epic wasn't pleased with the whole thing, but also on top of that, Apple, they claimed Apple was not following like the spirit of that. Like, Apple said you still couldn't put a link in the game. You had to apply for a special like entitlement for your game to allow you to do that external link. You had to put a warning saying like, you are leaving Apple's App Store. We don't know what's going to happen to you. And it like, you know, that kind of thing for leaving. And there were other things that really just basically Epic said, hey, the judge didn't have any of those details in there. Like, you made those up. And Apple's like, well, we're just going strictly by the, we don't like this. So we're going to just do as little as we can to enable this. And so Epic basically appealed for that one item. And it was ruled this last week that Epic is right. So Apple's got to change its rules and be better about allowing that stuff. So Apple said, we'll change our rules. And indeed, that very night, I, as a developer, got an email from Apple saying, you're now allowed to put links in your apps to buy stuff. There doesn't need to be an entitlement. There doesn't need to be a warning or anything. Oh, and the other part was, I remember this was a important part, is that even after you linked to your own store, you still had to pay Apple 27%.
Oh, because they came from the Apple
Yeah.
device.
So in other words, I would then have to go, if I was going to do it, and like calculate, oh, this, I made $1,000 in in-app purchases, and then write a check to Apple for that amount to give it back to them, right? And so they said no. So Apple doesn't, nobody needs to do that. Then there's no warning, and you could just have the link in there. No, nothing special. And Apple said, all right, well, we're going to appeal that. But in the meantime, here's the rule, because the judge made it clear that there's no negotiation. Do this now. Right? So the Apple said, okay. And they sent an email out and it says, you can now have links right to whatever you want, and you don't owe us anything. And but they have to be clean links out of the app. Like, it has to just go to the default web browser. And that's fine. But the weird thing is that when I got the email, like, so, well, yeah, let me go into this first. When I got the email, it was very specific as this is for US only. So, because it's a US ruling. And so I thought, okay, I checked off the box like almost every other developer, just make this available worldwide unless there's an issue. So my apps are available worldwide, except for like a couple, there's a couple of weird countries. Like, South Korea has some really weird rules where you have to put like your phone number and address up on their site and all this stuff. So there's a few countries that there's like other things. So forget those countries. Not 180 countries or whatever. It's like this. Now, if they say it's for US only, my question is, if I put a link in my game saying, hey, go to my page and you can give me money here, do I have to like make it only if you're in the US? Or like, could I only do it if the app is available only in the US? Like, if I say US only, nowhere else. And I haven't figured that out yet. There are a couple of apps out there that have already implemented this, Spotify and Amazon Kindle.
Of
And
course,
I and it's like, I don't really even know how to figure out, like, I mean, there's special rules in the EU, so you'd probably want to look in a place like Canada or Mexico or something, and then figure out like what happens there. I would imagine it would be easy for companies like Amazon to have, and maybe even Spotify because of licensing, to have completely different apps in different stores.
Yes.
Like, here's the US app, and that's what you see in the US. There's an actual Canadian app that's a different app, and that one's like Canada, UK, Australia, or something. You know, maybe that's one thing, or maybe that's what you have to do. I don't know. I don't really have good clarification on that. I don't really have any good way to find out. And so it's interesting. Also, it's only iOS and iPadOS. The only app that I've ever run into this issue with, that's not true, actually. It's happened twice for a very similar kind of thing. That recently, my app, my Clip Tools app, my Clipboard Manager for Mac, I had a list of links in there. You could go down to the bottom. There's a little menu, and it says like the most recent MacMost video, you know, the MacMost newsletter, you know, a couple things like that. Quick links. Hey, I might as well just plug my own stuff. And it had in there support this app at Patreon, and I linked to the Patreon for MacMost, which says that it supports MacMost and Clip Tools. The first like three times, the first three versions of Clip Tools, that went right through, no problem. And then somebody noticed it was there and said, you can't have a link asking for money outside of the App Store. Like, if you want people to contribute, they need to, you need to do it as an in-app purchase. So exactly what this whole thing is about, right? So the question is, you would think a link now is exactly what is allowed, except they're very specific: iOS, iPadOS. My app is Mac OS. So
So nothing's changed on the Mac.
I have a feeling that if I resubmitted just with that link there, that they would say, no, the rule's still in place for Mac OS. Or maybe not, because it may be that they don't want to say either way for Mac OS, but if you're going to force the issue, they don't want to invite any law other lawsuits. So it could be the kind of thing where like they're reserving the right to refuse it later, but right now they'll just let it through without saying anything, like pretending they didn't notice. So I don't know whether or not I'll do that, but that's another interesting thing about it. This, by the way, does not really change anything about getting Fortnite in the App Store again, because it's been banned. So Apple's terms of service were, you know, all these things, and Epic fought against them and then ultimately challenged them by putting in buttons to buy stuff directly from Epic, directly violating Apple's rules. I think they even made a big stink about the fact that they were going to do it, and then they did it. And then Apple turned around and said, you violated our rules, and we're going to enact the part of the rules that say, you knowingly violated our rules. Your company is now banned. And the judge in the initial ruling ruled that that stands. Like, they violated the contract. Apple can keep the ban as long, you know, if they want. So even if Epic says, oh, we're fine with the way things are now, we'll have a link, doesn't mean that it's coming back in the App Store, because Apple banned the developer and probably doesn't want to turn that around. Now, a way to get around that's been suggested is that when Apple started with the EU thing, where you could have your own little app store, but only in the EU, Epic put Fortnite back into their own store and submitted their own store to the App Store for the EU, and basically went that whole route. And the way they did that is they incorporated it in Sweden. So there's Epic and there's Epic Sweden. And Epic Sweden is what has the Epic App Store in the EU with Fortnite in it. So they're suggesting that perhaps Epic Sweden also resubmits Fortnite as another app worldwide. And the rumor is that Apple's has said that would be okay.
So, but for US users right now who want Fortnite, where are they getting it from?
They're just not playing it on the iPhone. They're playing it on their PC. They're playing it on their, you know,
Interesting.
Xbox. So they're just not. It was a hot mobile game until this happened, and then it went back to just being a hot like Xbox. I don't know if it's on other consoles too. I know people are playing the Xbox, a PC game that you could play as well. And yeah. So anyway, that kind of sums that up. It's kind of like, it's all legal stuff, and it's silly because on the one hand, I think it's silly that Epic was like, they don't want to give Apple the 30%, and that does seem like a lot. But on the other hand, the idea that Apple should just be like, you could do whatever you want and Apple gets nothing. Because if Apple said you could just have your own store, then the outcome may eventually be after several years that everybody has their own store, or more likely third-party stores. You know how like on websites now, Stripe is the king, right?
Right.
You can install Stripe so easily. So imagine Stripe, they move in and they say, hey, here's a little three lines of code, and now you can add Stripe to your app. And then within a few years, everybody switches to that. And then the entire app store in the iPhone is completely free apps. And in the app, there's a little Stripe checkout, upgrade to, from the trial to the full version, or the 30-day trial to beyond that, or buy this in-app purchase, all of it, and Apple gets nothing. And then the entire App Store model falls apart. They're spending, I think they estimated a few billion dollars a year on supporting the App Store, and suddenly the revenue drops to zero.
But to be fair, well, for one thing, I'm not going to be doing too much crying for Apple, right? I mean, I get that this is a business decision, but honestly, Apple ain't hurting. So if the App Store only had free apps with no in-app purchases, no in-app purchases, Apple wouldn't make anything. So the model is then to have either purchased apps, which you're buying through the App Store, or in-app purchases, which is what this controversy is all about. If another company were to come in, like say Stripe or any of it, there's others as well, but Stripe is the biggie. Isn't that really an argument for saying, you know what? This is what the marketplace is all about. This is called competition. Apple now has some competition. Would they not then have to either change their model or somehow make what they're offering more lucrative in comparison to these third-party apps?
Yeah, except that they, except the problem is, so say Apple said, okay, we'll have our Apple payment system and Stripe is going to be the competitor. Okay. Apple still has the overhead of all the bandwidth for the apps, for downloading the apps. And it's not trivial, right? All that bandwidth. All the overhead for all of the systems, like the in-app purchasing systems, the downloading additional content systems, multiplayer communication when it comes to games. There's all these parts to the App Store beyond this huge infrastructure that they've got that supports all the apps, plus the entire development environment, which is all from Apple, Xcode and Swift and all this stuff. Apple's developed all that. Stripe would have nothing from that. Like it wouldn't cost them anything. They would be getting that for free. And any developer would then be taking all this stuff from Apple, including the marketplace, right? Going, having the App Store maintained by Apple, including that. And then they would be like, okay, I'll give 3% to Apple for purchases or 3% to Stripe. And Stripe is like, well, we don't do anything except give you some code to put money through us. And Apple, on the other hand, does the same thing plus 50 other things that support the app itself. So it becomes a little tough. The alternative might be that Apple simply says, okay, well, we're just going to charge a fee per download. You want to be in the App Store, free, not free, in-app purchases, whatever it is, per download, it's going to cost a penny. And or maybe a penny if it's under 100 megs, if it's then a, under 200 megs, it's 5 cents, whatever it is. So a bandwidth issue. If you want to use our API for multiplayer gaming, it's going to be this. If you want to use our API for downloading additional content, it's that. They could just nickel and dime developers. And then you have like developers that want to do stuff for free that, on the one hand, are like, oh, I want to develop an app that 10,000 people are going to download. But suddenly now that's going to cost me $100. Whereas I'm just a student. I was just developing something that I think might help. Like it's a cool thing to help you find coffee shops in your area or whatever, there's that. And then there's also the threat, which has been around of like, I developed my little cool app and it takes off and it's free, right? I wake up one morning to find that a magazine has written about me. And I now owe Apple $4 million because of the number of downloads I got last night. So there's a lot of stuff like that that and I guess what's really helped the app development environment is the whole idea that you can develop something for free to see how it goes. And then go beyond that. Like so many apps were like, first version was free and it really took off. Let's develop version two, these new features, but we're going to charge for this one. Or let's add new features that have them as in-app purchases. But you can kind of dip your toe in the water and say, let's try this. Let's develop this app idea I've got. Whether you're an individual developer or like a couple people inside of a company that convinces their boss to like, hey, this would be like a useful thing we could develop in the company here. Having all this stuff where there has to be a budget up front, because Apple's charging you for all of the stuff, that's going to be, it's going to make it a harder sell.
Yeah, I was going to say it'll basically put the whole free app market out of business.
Right, and there's a lot of great free apps. There's a ton of great
Oh
ones.
yeah. Yeah, there
I
are.
love the free mod. I mean, that's what I did with ClipTools. ClipTools is totally free. I any all the ideas I've got for apps and things now, I think free would be the way to go. Even games, like I'd love to get back into making games, but I imagine if I would do it now, my initial thinking would be to whatever game I make, just make it totally free. If it doesn't do well, or if it does okay, then I wouldn't have made any money through in-app purchases or anything anyway. But at least I'm not sitting there thinking, wow, I wonder if the game would have been successful if I didn't charge $3 for it.
Right.
And then if it is hugely successful, then I could be like, great. Can I add in-app purchases or can I make a second version, a follow-up to the game that because the first game has a big following, now the second one, like it's an adventure game, and if you want to continue the adventure, the second one is going to be $3, but now I know that, 1 million people played it. That's the way I would do it personally if I was going to get back into it.
Complicated for sure. Yeah.
Complicated and and of course it doesn't really affect things too much for people in general. Like, most users of the devices, it doesn't affect them day to day.
Right. In other topics, it's time to talk about AI. Hooray. I ran across an article actually this morning. We've talked a lot about AI voice cloning. We had some examples here, and we've done various things with it. And the comment that I have in our notes, of course, is that it's in the wild, but it's more than that. It's gone mainstream. There's nothing more mainstream, I think, than United States televised sporting events. And as it turns out, what they're doing is they've got the voice of an announcer. Jim Fagan, who passed away several years ago, but he's coming back, right? They actually are using his voice in announcements for, I believe it is, yeah, the NBA on NBC. And I just thought that that was fascinating that you can now hear. And I did this. There's an example clip in the Verge article that I linked to in the show notes, where you get to hear him and. Absolutely. You would not know that this was not the real person if you did not realize it. I think that there is indeed a future for that because not necessarily that NBA announcers are that necessarily vocally recognizable. Although I'll admit that's not a pool I play in. I don't watch a lot of NBA basketball on TV. But the classic one that came to mind is James Earl Jones, the voice of Darth Vader. He actually did sign a contract before his death that authorizes, I think it's just Lucasfilms, but it could be others, to use samples of his voice to recreate new Darth Vader dialogue and possibly other things as well. That's a recognizable voice. And while there definitely are people that can do similar versions or imitations of the voice for various reasons, there's just nothing quite like James Earl Jones. So I'm just it's interesting to see exactly where this is headed and to see it hit the mainstream already in this situation. I just thought it was pretty interesting.
Definitely. Voice cloning is really interesting. I was actually playing a lot this week with voices. I have cloned my voice to 11 Labs and played around with that. I was doing the opposite this week using a variety of AI tools that actually take my voice and then make them another voice.
Oh,
So, in
okay.
other words, I record a video and I press a button and my voice is now another voice. And I
Gabriel
was doing,
Union.
yeah, well, yeah, I was just using their sample voices and stuff.
Sure.
So there's no celebrities there, but I was doing like the idea being that it makes it interesting. I don't have to use any kind of special mic, right, at all, really. But it was matching my voice perfectly. So it wasn't just, it was like transcribing my voice and then having an AI speaker speak it. Like my any pauses I had or times I was talking a little faster or slower, they were matched. So the lips were synced perfectly. And then I also tried clone, having another talking head in place of mine. So the interesting thing was, and this was a fun experiment, was I recorded a tutorial, an example tutorial, where it was me talking, so microphone only. I was doing screen capture. I ran it through this software, and I had a talking head at the bottom right-hand corner that was not me. It was an AI talking head with a voice to match that AI talking head, so not my voice. And it was just all done automatically. So it had the feeling of being the same kind of video that I make. And the content, like if you wanted to go and make an argument of like what's better, really, there was no difference. It was somebody else saying the same thing I would have said in the same way. And it was interesting, but I could have done the video instead of a fairly expensive camera, lights everywhere, cluttering up my space. I'm always staring at lights, even when I'm not using them. Green screen behind me, pads on the wall for soundproofing. Close the windows even on a hot day because I got to keep the sound out. And a really good microphone pointed at me, and I have to, do everything kind of like, get sound and video working perfectly. Forget all that. Just record the screenshot and use the microphone on my MacBook or whatever to talk while I'm doing it.
And then revoice it.
And then it gets revoiced and an image is added. And if it's, I was doing like a woman and it was a female voice and it was perfect. It was just like, it worked exactly as if it was a real person that looked like that saying those exact things. So it's interesting. It really got my mind going.
It's
Anyway, I don't know where I'm going with it, but.
what I find fascinating about the whole voice thing, the scenario you just described is essentially post-processing. In other words, you got the recording, and then you basically turn the technology loose on it, however long it takes. It can do a really good job. There's no lag. It's going to match your lips exactly. What amazes me are the voice changers in the real time, where they just kick in and they do the thing in absolute real time. The one that cracks me up is that there are now, I guess we still would end up calling them voice changers, but they are voice changers that would claim to remove accents, right? So if you've got, say, a strong southern accent or some other kind of accent, and you run it through this, it would still be your voice, but without the accent, which I find also just incredibly fascinating. It's funny because I was watching a video from a YouTube creator that I follow, who is talking about creating YouTube videos. And she's from the South. And she has, it's not a strong accent at all, but you can definitely tell it's not the flat Midwestern or Pacific Northwest kind of flat English accent, or American accent. But she has also pointed out that her accent for her videos is kind of a distinguisher. It makes her channel a little bit unique. People are drawn to that lilt, that kind of speaking. So I was also thinking, okay, well, let's reverse it. Let's take a flat accent such as mine and add a southern twang or a Brooklyn accent or something, anything. Anyway, I just the possibilities are absolutely fascinating, and the fact that it can all happen in real time just blows me away.
I actually tried exactly what you just said. It's funny. I picked a British accent and had it do that, and I was surprised to find that it kind of removed the British accent. So the voice was definitely the same voice, but because it was taking what I said and matching it to me, it like I had to listen to the sample. The sample was a strong British accent. The result was kind of like a really watered down British accent. And when I tried it on just some text, like say this text, strong British accent. So it was because it was taking what I said, and I guess it could only go so far to push it and make it different. But I did like the idea that it did make me sound, not only was the tone of the voice different, but it did change a little bit. And I also came to the conclusion that I've spent years trying to become more like a newscaster, right? Trying to get my ums and ahs out, and trying to like not be like, well, this is kind of like, if you clicked over here, you know. I want to be professional and say it.
Yes.
If I wanted to go this route and say create a series of videos where it looked like it was somebody else talking, and it was their voice and their image, but it was actually me being the puppeteer by speaking,
Sure.
I may want to go in reverse, and instead of making it feel like AI generated content, really try to make it feel like, no, this is not AI generated content, because the way the person talks is very casual.
Right.
That would be an interesting thing to have to, like, how would I force myself to be more casual? Anyway.
It's funny, you're right, because I have the same thing. When I sit down, I mean, it's different here. I mean, I'm sitting in exactly the same place, facing the exact same camera that I face when I'm doing my videos. But because it's you and I having a discussion, it's different. But indeed, when I sit down to record a video, I put on, I don't know if you want to call it a facade or a style or whatever, in terms of both how I look at the camera and how I speak to the camera, that you're right, it would be kind of difficult to not do after
Well,
as
it
many years as I've
might be
done.
important. I don't know. I don't know. I have to experiment more with that. It would be interesting to do an A/B test to like do it like my normal voice, but with a woman and a woman's voice, and then do an alternative take of the same content, but think in terms of a character of being like, oh, just, I don't know, somebody explaining this to like somebody else in the room and just talking casually, and then trying to do it that way and seeing if it comes off more natural.
The
Anyway,
only
speaking
thing,
of, yeah.
okay, go ahead. Yep, go
Oh, no,
for
I was going to say, speaking of natural versus or real versus fake, I was trying to do a segue to our next part. I
Real
failed.
ID is the topic, and I think it's what, tomorrow that it supposedly goes
Yeah,
into
tomorrow or
effect,
today that you'll be hearing this. Yeah.
and it's been 20 years in the making.
Yeah.
It's funny, I was thinking about it earlier. What problem is it really trying to solve? And the problem that apparently Real ID is trying to solve is simply that, especially in the United States, 50 different states had 50 different ways of determining that you are who you say you are when you apply for a driver's license. That's
Yeah.
basically it. There was no standard, there was no whatever. In some cases, it was enough to be breathing. In other cases, you need to bring a birth certificate and everything in between. So the standard, whatever the rules are for proving you are who you say you are and are authorized to carry this real ID piece of identification, you have to prove a couple of things. You have to have a social security number. I mean, whatever it is. What I find weird about this, and the reason this came up for me just a couple of days ago, is that I had to share my driver's license image with someone. And they said, "Oh, I'm surprised you haven't gotten a real ID." I had real ID for years. I mean, it's in Washington State, it's called an enhanced driver's license. And apparently, what's missing is there's a star that
Yeah, you don't have a
shows
star on your.
I have no star on my driver's license. And so that then leads into some of the confusion because technically, my driver's license is not quote unquote real ID, but it's good enough. In other words, the things that I had to, the hoops that I had to jump through to get my enhanced driver's license were sufficient for that then driver's license to be treated as quote unquote real ID. I did not know that. In fact, I learned that only this morning by reading the Verge article that I've got linked to.
Interesting. You may need to, like many other people in Washington, then I would assume, lose your ID somehow mysteriously and get a replacement.
I don't,
Because
that's the thing. I don't know if Washington State is actually issuing quote
oh,
unquote
any, even
real
now.
ID,
Huh.
right? Are they just doing the enhanced driver's license? And since that's good enough, right? Now, to
Yeah.
be fair, I'm the paranoid kind, right? So if I'm going to travel, Through a border that's going to require a real ID, which is typically the airport. Of course, I'm going to have my passport with me.
Oh,
Okay.
okay.
Of course, I actually have global entry, right? Which is an additional number of hoops I have to jump through, which also suffices as federal photo ID that's acceptable for real ID. Did you know that there's such a thing as a passport card?
Yeah, and I actually, I think my passport, it will be next time it's up for renewal, I can apply for both. You can just get both. That's what I found out was if you're renewing your passport, getting your passport card with the renewal, easy. If you want to get it without a renewal,
Right.
that's difficult. So, yeah.
And passport card isn't a passport, right? It doesn't work in all the
Yeah.
places that a passport would work. For example, if you're traveling overseas, I don't think a passport card is good enough. But on the other hand, if you're just traveling into Canada, maybe
Yes.
Mexico, then I think it does work. So anyway, again, more confusion. What kind of IDs do we
More
need? What
IDs. Yeah.
I'm concerned about are people showing up at the airport
Yeah.
tomorrow and whipping out their normal, not enhanced Washington State driver's license, and TSA going, sorry, you had 20 years to get this straightened out. It's too late. What I read in the article was that it's not like they're going to boot you from your flight. The phrase was, you may end up going through some enhanced screening,
Right.
which is honestly a terrifying phrase when applied to TSA. Anyway, it's here. It's confusing. I noticed what I did re read, and you actually called this out already. That's Colorado, not a problem.
It's a non-issue here because Colorado jumped right on it, right? A lot of states, ton of states went and said, oh, we don't want the federal government butting into our business of issuing IDs and stuff. So when this initially came out, there was a lot of resistance from certain states. And some states had no resistance. And Colorado was one that had no resistance to it. So it went right to Real ID, and it made the process of getting one basically, oh, next time you renew your driver's license, all our driver's licenses will now just be Real ID from now
Are
on.
they? Yeah.
And we won't have any spec. We already had, like, you had to prove who you are. We're not doing anything special beyond what we did before. So that happened in 2012. The
Good.
longest driver's licenses are for is 10 years.
Right.
So for almost 3 years now, Colorado has just had nearly 100%.
Right.
Matter of fact, it's 93%. The other 7% would be like mostly adults that don't have a driver's license for one reason or another, like seniors and
Right.
they who have stopped driving a long time ago. So Colorado has like no issue with it. And strangely, there was an issue with Colorado Real IDs early on. It was a weird thing. What I'm worried about with you is, you've got two issues. One is you're at the Seattle Tacoma Airport, where it's all people from Washington mostly getting on the planes, and the DSA people, they're going to be very aware of what your driver's licenses look like.
Right.
And maybe the first 100 people tomorrow might be the test candidates for what happens. But very quickly, they're just going to, get the hang of it, whatever they need to do. What happens when you first think of an airport like Denver or Atlanta or Cleveland? Who sees some Washington driver's licenses, but not that many. How long will it take them to catch on?
Oh, I see what you mean.
And yeah, and then you go to the even smaller ones. You go to a small airport that just has its one. Colorado Springs springs to mind. Just a few little flights here and there, or even tinier ones. But they're still, they still have 737s taken off, but maybe there's two a day. That kind of airport. How long will it take before the TSA people there are used to seeing, oh, Washington State driver's license, that they don't have the star? So
That
that's going to be a
sounds brief.
problem.
I mean, 50 is a short list, to be honest. And given that most of them will
Yeah.
have the star, the list of exceptions is going to be even smaller.
Well, we'll see. But the question is the exception, oh, it's Washington State, it's okay, or it's Washington State, it's not okay? Like, you always have to get into the other line. You know what I'm saying? It's like,
Yeah,
we'll have to
I see what you're
see.
saying. I guess we'll see. I guess we'll see.
And the thing about TSA is, of course, TSA is notorious for not having consistent rules. I mean, every it, the this you could travel on one day One day you can travel, go through TSA in one airport, and somebody will yell at you, you have to take your laptop out of your bag and take off your belt and put it in there. And then you get to the next airport and maybe you have a layover, then you go through TSA again.
Right.
And then you have somebody else yell at you, don't take your laptop out of your bag. You're holding up the line. Keep it in there. What are you doing? Don't take your belt off. I've had that happen, like both of those. And I'm like, I was just at another airport where they had me do these both, and now you're telling me to do the opposite. I'm fine with it. But why not be consistent? Number one. Number two, if you're gonna know you're inconsistent about certain things, have a sign in this airport. You, A, do not need to take out your laptop. B, this with your shoes, that with your whatever,
Be
tell
fair, I
us.
think SeaTac has those signs.
Good. Other airports don't. Definitely don't. You just have to be like, well, what's today? What's happening? Okay. And I wanted to bring up one more thing is that, of course, there are a bunch of states, and I'll pick on Pennsylvania because I have family there. So I hear about it, that they were the resistant ones to real ID. So they waited and waited and waited. I think Pennsylvania didn't act until 2019, right? Which was after the initial deadlines for getting this done, right? The initial deadlines were pushed back
Been
because
pushed
states like
several times.
Pennsylvania hadn't still done anything. And then Pennsylvania not only waited to the last minute, but they also said, oh, we're still going to give our standard IDs are not going to be real ID. It's a special ID that's going to be real ID, and it has additional requirements. An additional fee, and we're only going to offer them in 15 places throughout the state, and all this ridiculous stuff, making it very difficult. And I have family members that basically just determined it was easier to get a passport.
I was going to say, I mean, it seems like the default reaction is get a freaking
Just get
passport.
it, just get it back. And especially, like, one of the rules is that you have to show proof of your address, right? That you live where you say you live. Proof can be a driver's license, okay? And proof needs to be something else like a utility bill. That sounds pretty reasonable, except the requirements start at the age of 18. So, how many 18-year-olds have a utility bill? I mean, yeah. And there are a lot of 18-year-olds that still don't have a driver's license. I mean, we're older and we were used to, like, I turned 16 yesterday. I need to get my driver's license right away. But it
Today,
ha hasn't always been like that. And there's plenty of, it's fine. You don't feel you need to learn how to drive now or whatever. You don't. But now suddenly you don't have a driver's license. And even if you do, it's like, I don't have a utility bill in my name. I'm in a college dorm, or I still live with my parents, or I live with three roommates, and the utility bills are all on Joe's name because Joe was the one who had it together to actually, set it up. So it became like really impossible. You have all these 18, 19, 20-year-olds running around, not able at all to get a real ID because they just don't have that.
That's interesting. There's got to be, I mean, there seems like there must be a contingency for that. Although I suppose the contingency is the same one. It's easier just to get a passport.
Yeah. It's yeah. So the, yeah, the contingency is there really isn't one. You have to go to a totally different type of thing or whatever. And they estimate that it's like 30% of Pennsylvanians have a real ID now. So you have a huge number of people. So I hate to be TSA in Philadelphia or Pittsburgh tomorrow, because of this. Because
Watch for the headlines.
and other states like New Jersey and stuff also have similar issues. Anyway.
So
Yeah.
tariffs.
Yeah. So I just a quick little item here is I saw the first little blog post by somebody that about the tech tariffs. We'll link to an article. This company, Wise, which I think I actually bought something from a year or two ago. It was like an Amazon offshoot that creates things like security devices, little like lights that are solar powered that go on motion detector and stuff. I'm pretty sure I actually bought like floodlights like from them from our last house. Anyway, the CEO said he just got his first tariff bill, and the tariff for items manufactured in China is supposed to be 145% for most tech items with these exceptions. His items did not have any exceptions, and sure enough, he got something like a $250,000 bill for $167,000 worth of product. So, the 100, which is about 145%, the numbers kind of match up. So, Yeah, a whole shipment of their stuff now sitting in Amazon warehouses that you could buy on Amazon for these little lights. The company had to pay a ton of money for to get them into the US. They say that they've been working to move their manufacturing from China to Vietnam, but they're
Right.
still 60 days away from that.
They've been apparently trying to do that for a year,
Yeah.
right? They've been working on this
Tough.
for some time. It is no small change to move, pack up your manufacturing and move
Oh,
it
yeah.
anywhere.
And he mentions in the article, it's something that's obvious as well. It's like moving manufacturing to the US for 0% tariff doesn't work because the different parts come from other countries as well. So even if you move the factory here, you still have to import the parts. You would have to actually then go and look at all those parts and then move those factories here. And
Right.
then some of those parts are made out of parts. So
Well,
you.
and all of the parts are made out of raw materials, and those
Yeah.
raw materials have to come from somewhere, and it's often not the United States.
Yep. So there's that. And I don't want to say much more, but there's also, of course, the possibility of tariffs on Hollywood movies, which is very confusing as to how that even works because it's a digital product.
It
Like
cracks
how,
me up.
where, when, at what point does the importing actually happen? If somebody makes a movie in, Canada, it's like what, and then it get released in theaters. It's not like there are reels of film that have to be loaded onto a truck and brought across the border. It's just
Yeah.
a digital file that gets updated on servers for theater companies.
Yep, it's crazy. Yeah, so we'll see. I like I said, I don't know where a tariff on any digital product, honestly, would really apply. There's just no such thing as a concept of an import. I did want to point out that Wyze, the company, they're
Yeah.
just not that far from here. They
Oh,
actually
yeah,
they're
cool.
headquartered not that far
Which makes
from where we're.
sense. It's Amazon related company, yeah. Cool. Another thing I wanted to get on talk about briefly is I was talking to a friend of mine the other day, a friend of the show, I guess, Jay Schaefer, who is an amateur astronomer. The calling him amateur is really it doesn't do service to the photos that he posts are incredible. I mean, he lives in New Mexico and takes amazing astrophotography photos and posts them online and all of this. He's just really become an expert using optics and stuff and different cameras and equipment and to take pictures. But he was telling me the other day that when he takes a long exposure picture now, you expect there to be some. Meteor, your hope for some meteors to go across. That's what you want. It's like, oh, I caught a cool meteor flashing across my 4 hour exposure of the stars. But in addition, you usually get some satellites. And it used to be you would get a satellite, it would be a constant streak all the way across, or sometimes they flare, so it's like a dashed line as the satellite reflects light at different angles. And then the cool thing is you used to be able to like identify what the satellite was. Oh, that's the, CBS satellite, whatever. And but now of course it's the images are filled with Starlink satellites. More and more going up all the time. And now Amazon is launching their own array, starting to. So eventually that will double the number of satellites. I believe there's a EU project as well to launch more satellites. So there's going to be many multiples of these small little satellites for giving us internet anywhere in the world, which is really nice. But the heyday of astrophotography may be at an end because eventually it's going to get so hard to take field photos where you see lots of stars without having crisscross of all these satellites. It'll be easier if you want to focus on something like, say, the Orion Nebula. And
Right.
then hope a satellite doesn't cross the little tiny arc of
That particular
space.
window, yeah.
And but you may want to plan for several shots because you may get one of these in there. But anyway, it's interesting. It's great that we're getting more internet connectivity and competitors to Starlink. On the one hand, on the other hand, there is something that's kind of dying because of it.
It's yeah, the only thing that comes to mind for me is that it's not this, it's certainly not the same, and it's certainly not even close to being the same price range. But when you think about it, the only way to get now high quality stellar photography without all of these satellites in the way is to be above them.
Yeah.
So things like Webb and Hubble, and presumably maybe there'll be some other that will, come up at some point in the future. But that seems like about the only approach to it, which is.
Yeah, in the future. I know it's a shame, and it's the, you know, and the funny thing is that it wasn't that long ago where you had to spend a lot of money to take good amateur astrophotography photos. And now there are some products that are amazing. For a few $1,000, you can get these devices that are like telescopes that just take exposure after exposure and do it all automatically and tilt with, you know, the rotation of the Earth, and will layer it all together, and you can all control it from your phone. So you could be sitting inside where it's warm and have the telescope outside. And it's like, and these things are so cheap compared to what it used to cost to be able to do the equivalent. So it's becoming in the range of more and more people to do astrophotography at the same time that it's becoming impossible to do surface-based astrophotography.
Now, a question. The satellites that we're talking about here, the Amazon or the Starlink satellites, they're in low Earth orbit, right? They're like couple hundred miles, 300 miles up.
Yeah, or even less, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I keep getting it confused with where the space station is. But what that means, though, is that the only time that they are really visible, and this is true for any satellite, actually, but the only time they're really visible is when the sun is at an appropriate angle just below the horizon, either in the morning or at night. If the sun is well, literally behind the Earth with respect to what it is you're looking at, then the satellites aren't really reflecting any light. They don't have anything to reflect.
I don't, yeah, you are right. It's between 210 and 340 miles, according to
Cool.
ChatGPT. But I don't think that's the case. I mean, I have personally observed lots of satellites crossing almost directly overhead late at night. And
But they
the,
only
so,
have to be high enough.
yeah.
And the sun has to be low enough, high enough, however you want to look at it, that even though the sun is set from your perspective,
Yeah.
its beams are still making it across the Earth into, to
Yeah.
down the satellite.
I suppose it's enough. I mean, I don't know. I'm not going to try to work out the angles on the
No.
spot,
And
but it's.
honestly, I mean, if it's an issue, it'd be worth asking your friend Jay if that is in fact
Yeah, I will.
where the interference is coming from in the middle of the night.
And I did want to mention that he just started a an audio podcast called Deep Sage 9. Sage is a reference to his location in New Mexico. His very dark sky area that he lives. And yeah, so he started an audio podcast. I'll link to that as well.
An oblique reference to Deep Space Nine.
Yes, exactly.
All righty, say what's cool this week? So we finished watching The Righteous Gemstones over the weekend. Have you watched that one at all?
No, I have not.
It is on Max, or it was on Max. It was the final episode of the final season. And it is a parody of basically mega churches, the big mega churches and the personalities behind them. And it's been hilarious. It's been quite the ride. It has John Goodman, Walton Goggins, both are in there. It was really kind of weird because for a few weeks, Walton Goggins was in both White Lotus and Righteous Gemstones. In fact, in some cases, one right after the other, since they're both on Max, playing two completely different characters. I mean, he couldn't be different. He's quite the versatile actor. Anyway, we enjoyed it a lot. We had a lot of fun watching it. There are some aspects of it that seemed almost a little over the top, but yeah, we're sort of sad to see that one go. Righteous Gemstones.
I just finished reading a new book called When the Moon Hits Your Eye by veteran sci-fi author John Scalzi. And basically the whole premise for the book, he wrote it as almost seems like a challenge to himself, is what would happen if the moon would suddenly turn into cheese? And he writes it as a serious science fiction book. That's the premise. That's what happens at the beginning of the book, and then he carries it forward. It's an interesting book. It's a series of kind of interconnected short stories. Mostly, it's really about people's reactions and what how it changes people's lives, more than the science fiction of the moon turning to cheese. But that is the overbearing thing, is the moon has turned to cheese. So it's really interesting. And when I first read it, I read it for plot. I wanted to know what happens, right? What happens now that the moon has turned
How did
into
that happen?
cheese? Yeah, how and why and all this. But then when it's done, now I find I'm reflecting back on some of the interesting things that people did and said in reaction to that, you know, how the government reacted, how people reacted, how scientists reacted, how normal people, how, you know, a book writer's, I mean, he's got a character that's a book writer, and, you know, looking at her career based on now that this has happened. So it's a fascinating, interesting, really different sci-fi book by, and of course, he's a great writer. So it's just he's so easy to read. You just slip right into this world he's created and
That one
you go
is
through it.
bizarre enough that I may just have to pick it up and find out what the heck is going
Yep.
on. Blatantly self-promoting ourselves. The one I'm going to point folks at this week is the enduring myth of annual subscriptions to Windows. This is an issue that came up with Windows 10 first was released because somebody in Microsoft marketing described it as software as a service. And they were referring to things like continual updates, online connectivity, that kind of stuff. But a lot of people took that to mean that not only is it going to be software as a service, but it means we're going to have to start paying for it on a regular basis, like an annual subscription or a monthly subscription or something like that. It's the myth that won't die because it now has come up again with the impending demise of Windows 10 and the the upcoming a requirement, if you will, of Windows 11. So anyway, I wanted to talk about that some. It's askleo.com/180253.
Cool. And I'll link to a video from late last week. It turns out, I don't know why I didn't realize this before, because it's really obvious that one of the messiest places on people's computers is their contacts app, right? I mean, who maintains that thing, right? And gets rid of old contacts, and it keeps things updated. Nobody does. So I did a video on, you know, how to kind of clean that up, because there's some tools for cleaning up, especially people end up with duplicates. The Apple Contacts app is interesting because, in the interest of being inclusive, you end up with duplicates because you sign into your Google account. Hey, your Google account has contacts. The Contacts app will show them. It'll show your iCloud stuff. Oh, you signed into Yahoo. Let's show your Yahoo ones. So then you find in your Contacts app that you've got like three different contacts of the same person, and you're wondering why. And if you don't look carefully, you won't notice that, oh, this one's iCloud, this one's Google, and this one's Yahoo, and that's why I have three.
And heaven forbid one of them have a different phone number than the
Yeah,
other.
yeah.
We've changed.
So you could
Yeah.
merge them, you could link them, which is interesting, and you know, just generally, just you know, a video about just kind of cleaning that stuff up. It went over so well. I'm considering doing videos on like cleaning up your calendar, you know, and other kinds of things like that.
Cool. Alrighty, well, I think that pretty much wraps us up for yet another week. As always, thank you everyone for listening, and we will see you here again real soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The show notes for this week are at tehpodcast.com/teh248. If you have a comment or question for us, be sure to leave it on the show notes page. The TEH podcast is hosted by Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com and edited by Connie Delaney. I'm your synthetic announcer, Adam, from 11labs.com. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you here real soon.